subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and this week it is just Martin and I. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. Not bad at all. It's a cloudy day. We've had probably about 2 months of rain in the past week, but it's decent.
Yeah, perfect weather for living at the top of a hill.
All right, you live at the top of a hill, do you?
Well, not really, but if I had to choose, I'd choose to live at the top of a hill because of the amount of rain we've had. Certainly, rain doesn't run uphill, does it? Let's face it.
Yeah, but it's been a bit windy as well. You could get blown off that top of a hill. You want to live about halfway down, I think.
That is true. Right. So, it's just you and I today, and we're going to look at an interesting development in cloud, hybrid cloud, I guess you could call it. And that's the idea of Anthos, which is a Google solution. We'll go into what exactly that is at the moment, in a moment. And specifically, storage partners for Anthos, which is something that came out this week, didn't it? It was something that was announced by Google this week.
Yeah, it's something which I noticed this week, that Google had an announcement about storage partners for Anthos. And I made me think, why do they need storage partners? Why aren't they doing it all themselves? Maybe we should just have a chat about Anthos in general and what it is and how it plays into the area of potentially hybrid cloud.
Yeah, brilliant. Right, so let's see. Let's start there then. Let's start and say, what is Anthos? Now, probably, I would imagine there's a lot of our American listeners are going, never heard of it. Well, you might call it Anthos. We call it Anthos. So that's what it's going to be while we're on this podcast. So what is it, Martin?
It appears to be a Kubernetes container platform, as far as I can see. That's what we, Google seem to be claiming it is. It's Kubernetes, it's Istio, it's Knative. It's all those buzzwords which get thrown around as part of your Kubernetes or container environment. But it seems to allow you to run these containers both on-premises and actually in Google's cloud at the same time. As far as I can see, it's an umbrella for a number of different things.
Now, I had a look at it, and I looked at the documentation that they have online. I found like an architecture diagram that sort of gave a little bit of that. And it seems to me that it isn't like a standalone solution that you'd run in your own data center, but it's more like an extension of Google Cloud in the sense that it allows you to run containerized workloads on your on-premises environment, but actually the whole management is driven still from the Google Cloud itself.
Oh yeah, so it still seems to be, yeah, you could say, so you'd move all your management of your infrastructure onto the Google Cloud console.
Yeah, so, and this is an interesting model, and it's a model we've seen already to a certain degree. So let's think of Amazon AWS Outposts, which is hardware in your data center, but actually it's basically totally useless without a connection to the Amazon cloud, because that's where all the management comes from. And it's not like buying hardware from Dell and integrating it into a hybrid solution. You buy it from them and it'll only work for them, and it's driven by Amazon's cloud. And it looks to me like this solution, the Anthos solution from Google, is working to a similar model.
It does, but it's a lot more inclusive, I would say. Amazon, okay. As you say, with Outposts seem to want to run, basically you're going to buy Amazon hardware and you're going to run it in your data centers.
Okay. Where does this run? Because I couldn't see anything about what the hardware was that this sits on.
For
Anthos.
Anthos lists a number of platform partners.
Right.
So, weirdly enough, there's Atos, which is an odd one. There's Dell, Intel, NetApp, Cisco, HPE, and Lenovo.
Okay. So you have got the ability to go and get what is pretty standard hardware, deploy this on, and then connect it to the Google Cloud, and off you go.
It appears to be.
Okay. Interesting. Now, we talked about some of the services that are in there. So things like Istio, I think, is being used as the service mesh. There's config management. There's obviously the container engine from Google. All of those are effectively giving you the sort of the raw bits and pieces to run applications that are containerized. But there's a couple of gaps there. Networking is one I hadn't really looked at, so we'll put that aside for now. But clearly the one that's of interest to us here is storage and what they're going to do with the storage side of things.
This is where I think it's interesting to look and see what it is and why people would want to partner with Google, or why these vendors would be interested in getting themselves certified against Google, and how it's going to integrate into this whole hybrid cloud model.
Okay, so before we dive into that and look at you know, what's an offer and so on. I thought it might be worth spending just a couple of seconds talking about storage for containers in general, because if you look back into when Docker was a thing and still existed as something we might want to deploy, not saying it isn't today, but it's sort of been superseded to a certain degree by Kubernetes. Initially, everybody said, oh, you don't need storage. You know, it'll all be fine. Everything will just run all the time. If we need to protect it, we'll replicate it to another container. And we found pretty much that isn't the case. And I think the reason we found that isn't the case is because somewhere within that infrastructure, somehow you've got to retain state and persistence in order to know where you stand. And bit by bit, we seem to have been moving back towards accepting that the storage platform is probably the right place for that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to accept the fact that persistence is important. I mean, your company's data has to live somewhere and persist. If it doesn't, what are you doing? Not every workload is ephemeral. Your data workloads are not ephemeral. The workloads which process those data, that data may be ephemeral and might come and go, but that data, people talk about data as the new oil, or the data is your gold in your enterprise. Well, so it has value. You've got to store it and keep it somewhere.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as we've decided to maybe look at the idea of containerizing applications that initially people didn't think they would containerize. So theoretically, right or wrong, you can containerize traditional databases, new and NoSQL databases. You could put all of those in containers. And let's face it, if you create a 1 terabyte MongoDB database, you don't want to be thinking if that container just crashes, you've got to replicate that entire terabyte again just to bring up that instance, that replica. Surely it makes so much more sense just to reinstance the container and have it all that data stored on a persistent volume you can continue using again. That seems like so much more of a logical approach. So I think we've moved to a situation where we think persistence is really, you know, still practical and still has significant value even in the container environment.
Yeah, it's this disaggregation between compute and data, which is the traditional model. There's a reason why it's been around for a long time. I think at one point some of the container people thought it wasn't important. It was 1950s, 1960s technology. And I think now people begin to realize, or not even beginning to realize, have realized that this data needs to live outside of a container in general.
Yeah, okay. Let's go on and talk about Anthos storage then. And I think they've described it, and I think I've in our little notes, I've put it in quotes. They've actually called it Anthos Ready Storage, haven't they? And the partners are really quite an interesting mix that are mostly traditional vendors.
Oh yeah, very much so. That's what threw me. I was expecting to see a whole load of new companies, but of the companies which had listed, one's a little bit unfamiliar to me, one I do know about, and the rest of them are very familiar to us. You had NetApp, Portworx, Robin, HPE, Dell EMC, and Pure. Of the two which I'm a lot less familiar with, Portworx and Robin, with Robin being the partner, I had to go and have a look at their website to try and work out what they did.
They were originally Robin Systems, and I think they started off with a container appliance from memory, and that a few years ago. So that basically, I think they thought we'd end up with dedicated hardware appliances for running containerized workloads rather than maybe Linux machines that ran them or running them in VMs, or even currently today where we've got Kubernetes deployments that sort of encapsulate that for you. I think they thought we'd go down the route of having like super massive mainframe style container engines as physical hardware. So I think their original solutions were all hardware based, but then they pivoted towards the software side, which is probably what you found on their website, I guess.
Yeah, I have. I'm still not entirely clear from their website exactly what it does. So if anybody from Robin listens to this and wants to come on the podcast and talk about what they're doing, what the value proposition is, or what is their unique selling point, I think we'd be very happy to have them on.
Yeah, I think so. I looked at the website as well and I was equally confused, and I got to the point of, oh, look, click this button to try it out. And then there was a requirement to register, so I stopped.
Yeah.
Didn't go any further. But you're right, looking across the list of vendors, you've got Portworx, which we know something about. They've been around for a little while. And, you know, they're a distributed, containerized, scale-out storage platform. So they sort of fit the market here. But obviously, the outside of that, you've got what are literally major traditional vendors.
Yeah, very traditional, with Pure obviously being the newest of them. But they probably won't like us for saying it, but they are a traditional storage company.
So let me just go through them and sort of from my perspective give an opinion on what I think. So NetApp, we've seen a lot of work, and NetApp have done a lot of work with a plug-in environment called Trident, which we haven't really talked about very much in the podcast, I don't think. and I've not written a huge amount about online, but that's their attempt to interface the idea of their platforms with cloud native type workloads. And I think they were quite early on in that environment. And this was before CSI, and we'll come on to what CSI is in a second, but that was before CSI was really sort of developed. Obviously, Pure Storage at the other end of things, they've put a lot of focus onto the container environment, and they've got, I think it's called the Pure Storage Orchestrator, which is used to do that. So they've got a sort of, you know, quite a good focus on it. And then that puts us into the HPE and Dell environment. Now, put HPE aside for a second and go and talk about Dell. I saw some of the thinking that Dell had around automation. I think we talked about it a few weeks ago, and this was at a Tech Field Day presentation where they talked about their automation attempts and how they were looking to do stuff. So clearly they've got stuff. The one I'm not sure about here is exactly what HPE are doing. So I can see sort of some of the vendors doing stuff, but I'm not really sure exactly what they're doing and what platforms they're supporting it on across the board, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, HPE, I think HPE is as a storage strategy, it's a topic for another day. But yeah, it's Dell EMC have been talking about cloud and Kubernetes, and it fits into them as an infrastructure provider all the way up. If you actually think of VMware and the stuff they're doing, they've done with Pivotal, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yes, I guess what you're saying there is that Dell seem to have an approach to do some sort of work with the cloud native side of things, but I must admit I would say that I haven't seen a strategy from HPE to do anything around that.
Yeah, but so HPE strategy has been interesting because it's been very, very focused on Azure and Microsoft. I was surprised to see them listed with the Google side of things, and I wasn't thought they would be one of them. Dell EMC didn't surprise me, and the NetApp certainly didn't surprise me.
Okay, so let's look at how on earth these vendors might have been qualified and what basis they're included in this, because the whole point is that it's called Anthos Ready Storage. So there are a certain set of requirements that are there that the vendors have to meet. And in my notes again, I've put in must support in quotes because looking at them, they do seem quite vague. So the four that I found were the ability to deploy the CSI driver. We'll come on to that again in a second. Some have some core functions like dynamic provisioning, which I guess by that they mean automation. Scale up and scale down, which you'd think would be everybody. And then this idea of workload portability, which I think is quite fascinating too, and we'll come back to that in a second. So first of all, CSI, we know that in the Kubernetes environment, instead of needing to have drivers that are in the code tree, if you like, in line, and therefore every time you change the driver, have to put in a new release of Kubernetes out. So what we've ended up with is something called the container storage interface. So this is basically a generic interface that the vendors program to, and that means you don't need to keep changing the code every time you change your driver. Your driver can change all the time, but you just write to the standard driver that Kubernetes provides. So that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, in the CSI driver, I've not actually used it. I've not really looked too much at it, but I do know there's some very basic levels of what it provides, but also you can extend it so you can support things like snapshots, raw block, online expansion as well. So there are various CSI drivers out there.
Yeah, it's an attempt to really standardize on the sort of common requirements you would have. And I would say anybody who's looked at OpenStack, and we talked about Cinder the other week, anybody who's looked at OpenStack will know that the Cinder driver was an attempt to try and standardize the ability for OpenStack environments to talk to generic storage and from vendors and so on. So I looked at the code and I've looked at it and thought, yeah, it's got similar sort of concepts and constructs, and it's not entirely block focused, but it's majority block storage focused to connect to this environment. But yeah, it's basically a generic interface to allow you to consume storage from different vendors, and the vendors write to it. So HPE have had that one out for a while. I think they might have done the Nimble one first. Pure have definitely had one. NetApp have had it. Portworx are native for that, and obviously Robin must have that too, and Dell definitely have, because they had a whole code environment code team writing this sort of stuff. So fair enough. CSI driver makes sense. And I guess what we could say is that any other vendors who come along afterwards, if they've already got a CSI driver, they're going to tick that box straight off, aren't they?
Yeah, they should do. I was going to say, as an aside, did you realise there's a CSI driver for the Cinder driver?
That seems a bit like Inception. That seems like an extra layer you don't really need.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So that one should be pretty straightforward. And then you've got things like dynamic provisioning. Again, I assume that just simply means automation, that the CSI driver can drive the storage and it's fully automated. So that one should seem pretty straightforward too. And then scale up, scale down, we've said that already, but supporting workload portability, this one I think is interesting because there's no real definition of what that means. And unless you found something more than I did, Martin, I never found anything to say what that really meant.
Yeah, I have no idea. Workload portability seems to be a bit of an umbrella term and could mean many, many things.
It could, couldn't it? It could mean we're moving stuff between arrays. It could mean we've got the ability to move or represent LUNs between multiple clusters of Kubernetes. Or even it could mean that they're thinking that the data could be moving into the cloud. I don't know. And I think one thing that comes out looking at all of these definitions is they don't seem that rigorous and they don't seem like there's a big validation process to go through to get yourself on that list.
Yeah, if it's to do with the CSI drivers, obviously there's a huge amount of CSI drivers out there. So to validate it all would be difficult, but I don't know why they picked those particular group, because it does seem to be, it was, as we said, it was an interesting group of companies. There's some very big companies, and then there's some much smaller companies. And I don't know how it's come about, but it's those five.
No. Now, that is an interesting question. So I'll throw out a couple of things here that I think might be interesting. First of all, I think we might guess that Google would want to go after the enterprise because that's got to be where the money is. So maybe by targeting vendors who already have strong enterprise customers, maybe they're seeing this as a lead-in to help them getting into those enterprise customers. That's one scenario. Certainly from a NetApp perspective, the fact that there are two brothers, one running NetApp and one running Google Cloud, maybe that's got some relevance to why NetApp's quite high up on that list too.
Well, do you think they sit there over dinner or over the Thanksgiving table or the Christmas dinner table talking about how they partner?
Yeah, why wouldn't they? Let's face it, if you know somebody reasonably well and they run another company and you think, do you know what, I'd really think it'd be worth getting involved with them or talking to you, you sort of mix with them and you find out what they're working on without giving any sort of proprietary secrets away, then I'm sure you must talk about that sort of stuff. And if you're brothers and you get on, you know, surely they must talk to each other.
I now have a vision of the Mercurian brothers trying to kill each other with the carving knife.
Actually, do you know what? If you've ever looked at pictures, I think they are so similar. You could quite easily get one confused with the other. They're so alike. I'm not sure whether they're twins or not, but they do look really, really similar. But, you know, if you've got that sort of connection and you can use it, then that's how a lot of large businesses do it, all sorts of work, don't they? I'm sure Bill Gates spoke to all sorts of people when he was head of Microsoft.
I'm sure he did, very, very much so. Yeah, but it is an interesting dynamic, that one.
I think it is, and I wonder whether that requirement or that focus on enterprise is biased slightly the vendors that are in that list, because ultimately you're looking at people who maybe already have hardware on-prem, that are already running their applications on-prem. And effectively, you're looking for that little, I guess, beachhead into how you get to them and how you get them consuming the Google Cloud Platform with as little friction as possible. And in this instance, if you're talking about using traditional hardware, traditional storage, and the only thing you've got to do there is run some different software on it, getting that up and running becomes, well, theoretically, I guess, really easy to do.
Yeah, it does, and it makes it much easier for things like proof of concepts and things like that to happen, because the enterprise you're trying to sell in to may already have some hardware there, so you don't have to worry about shipping racks full of hardware. It's a startling contrast in approach between, well Google and obviously Microsoft as well, a very, very similar approach by partnering with people, as opposed to Amazon who want to own the whole ecosystem, the whole infrastructure. So if you want to deploy outposts, you provide them some data center space. But from then on, it's Amazon. It's Amazon, it's Amazon, Amazon, Amazon. Whereas with this, you could still use your existing hardware. You could POC it. You could see whether you like it or not. You don't feel that you're tied to one particular hardware vendor. And if you fall out of bed with Google, that's fine. That's not a problem, because you can reuse the hardware you've got on premises.
Yeah. The question there, I guess, to ask is, if you're looking at either of those two approaches, first of all, there's that one of lock-in and being tied to a partner. So if you went down the Amazon route, if you can't get out of that 3-year contract you put in there, or if you can't get them to agree to give you the technology to try it out for a few months and see how it goes, you're pretty much, I would be negative towards that sort of approach, simply because I wouldn't want to be buying into something I couldn't easily get out of. On the other hand, if you look at the other approaches, the Google and Azure approach, as you said, much more easy to try out, much more easy to just dabble and see what you really think. And it makes you wonder what's the right approach here, because from Google's perspective, from Microsoft's perspective, they're going to be more likely to partner with some of the existing hardware vendors. And I'm guessing Google doesn't want to get into the hardware business particularly. So this is probably an easier approach for them to do than Amazon are taking.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by Google not getting into the hardware business, actually. I thought they might want to. I understand Microsoft have stayed away from the enterprise hardware business. Obviously, they're now in the consumer devices or in endpoint devices. But Google, it wouldn't have surprised me if they had got involved in it and actually thought, you know, we can do this. Amazon, for whatever reason, it didn't surprise me that if they were going to do this, they were going to do it with their own custom hardware. I could have seen Google do hardware, but in a very different form.
So what's the sort of the long-term strategy then here? So imagine Google get you to look at Anthos. You can put it on your existing hardware. It's relatively easy to try it out. But really, when we talk about this, it's not about the hardware. It's not about the platform or the infrastructure in that sense. It's about the applications and the data. So what's the scenario there? You know, what are they doing to potentially either make your life easier or, if we're being cynical, to try and move your applications and workload into the mothership, into the core Google data centers?
Well, it seems that one of the Park Anthos's core offerings is the migration offering, to allow you to migrate your existing traditional workloads, be it VMs or I suspect even bare metal, how they will containerize an existing workload. And I assume they allow you to containerize and still run it within your own data center. I imagine they would like you to run it within their cloud platform. But it does seem to be very focused. We'll take what you have existing and we'll cloud wash it. We'll make it look modern. We haven't really made it look modern. There's some very interesting claims if reading the migration spiel about it. But once you've containerized it, you don't have to worry about security or operating system patching and things. I think, well, that's not true, because if you containerize an application and you've containerized that whole environment, you've got a single artifact which may be running a very out of support operating system. Does that magically mean it's more secure? Maybe it does, because you can control the networking a little bit, but it's not magically any better. Yeah, so but they seem to be very focused on, okay, we're struggling to get into the enterprise. So how do we help enterprises consume our platform? What we do is we'll just lift and shift. That's what there seems to be, some of this seems to be focused on. We'll lift and shift your monolithic application and we'll move it into something where you can run it in our cloud.
That's an interesting approach, because let's talk about, say, any of the classic databases. So imagine you're, I don't know, a huge bank in London. You may well have hundreds, if not thousands, of Microsoft SQL Server, or even if you've been a bit ahead of yourself, you might have some MySQL in there, or it might all be lots of Oracle. Now, imagine you could, for sake of argument, containerize any of that sort of stuff really easily. Some of it you can, some of it you can't. Imagine you could do that. Then this idea of, oh, you don't have to worry about software upgrades anymore, doesn't really work, because if you're running database version 1 and then next week you're suddenly running database version 2, what you don't know is whether the on-disk structures are different enough that when you reinstance that container with that new software version on that same data, it looks at it and goes, oh, I don't like that. That's different. That's not right. So there's still got to be upgrade processes around on-disk structures for structured data and so on. Other stuff, yes, I can see that, but I think that's as you said, cloud washing for absolute definite. But lift and shift, what does that give you? So what that made me wonder is, what are they doing to help people understand what the cost profile looks like? Because from a, you know, day zero type stuff, we could try this out, but really, how does it translate into more efficient operations and lower cost? I didn't see anything around that side of it, did you?
Well, no, I didn't. So you don't see anything around for, if you were to move traditional workload, and we think of traditional workloads within the enterprise, and whether it's actually a necessity or not, but people don't turn off applications overnight. So anything you put in the enterprise generally is ticking away running 24/7. And there are good reasons for that. We now live in a 24/7 world. A 24/7 fat application is probably going to run cheaper on your on-premises infrastructure than moving it into the cloud. It's just the way it is. So unless they're doing some clever stuff and actually starting to automate or put machine learning in around the FinOps, the cloud financial operations, which is now the latest, greatest thing. And if anybody wants to progress their career, that's where they need to go. So unless they're doing some of that for you, so you do realize that application you've now just migrated into the cloud actually doesn't need 8 CPUs, doesn't need to be up between these hours, or we can work out a way of quiescing it down for you. That would be of massive value to an enterprise, but I don't see that in there at the moment.
Yeah, I'd agree. I didn't see that. And I guess if I was looking at this from my perspective, and there is talk about dashboard and there's cluster management and other things that are around there, and config management and so on, I'd expect to have something that was going to show me, here's what you were doing before, here's how we can change it, here's what the improvement is, here's where your wastage is, and really be very strong in that auditing process that goes through and tells me why this was even worth doing in the first place. Because let's face it, if it's not easily demonstrable, and we talked just a couple of weeks ago about businesses expecting return within sort of 12 to 18 months, if it's not going to be demonstrable, why on earth am I doing it?
Yeah, so you need this return very quickly, which is we've talked about it. It is a problem. Finance departments want to see a return in a year, 18 months at the outside on doing something. So unless they have tools which can really start to show that you will get a return, and these are very firm returns. So if you turn around to finance and say, you know what, if I do this for 3 years, but at the end of 3 years, my IT costs have halved, they may relax the 18-month thing, and you may find that you have a very sensible discussion at that point. If you're a CEO, I would want to be having that kind of conversation. But you need to be able to demonstrate that, and you also need to come up with metrics which are firm. So when things do change, that on either side, you have something to go back on and say, okay, that's changed. It's all about giving you a predictable cost.
Okay, let's go back and as we sort of wrap up, let's go back and just talk about what we were originally starting with, and that was this whole idea of storage. So from what I can see so far, what we're saying is that this is all about plugging existing storage, physical hardware, into the infrastructure to allow you to basically run Kubernetes persistent workloads, which are going to be typically block devices connected to your Kubernetes environment. And that's then going to be knitted together with a service mesh to make sure that if you've got lots of individual Kubernetes clusters, they all work consistently. But of course, that's not all of your data, is it? You know, at the end of the day, there's a huge amount of data that's going to sit outside of this environment. And there's going to be a big challenge for people to think about how all of that data becomes integrated both into this environment, but secondly, if you do decide to move some of these workloads into the cloud, how are you going to continue to access that too? So there's a big, much bigger picture from a data and storage perspective to look at here.
Yeah, yet again, it's a data and storage is a complicated thing. So you're going to have to make the assumption that the data you have needs to be accessible from anywhere, whether it's sitting within a Anthos off-premises cloud or on-premises cloud. But you also want things you potentially in the world of multi-cloud, you want to make sure that data is available for you. Might be running something in Azure because you've just got a lot of Microsoft workloads and it's a cost effective to run your Microsoft workloads. You might have something which you want to consume in AWS. You say, for instance, in media, you might want to run AWS workloads of transcoding because they're much more mature than, say, the equivalents in Google. So the storage becomes the Switzerland of your data center. Everybody talks to it, it becomes neutral, and it needs standards to ensure that neutrality.
Okay, I think it'll be interesting to see how we see the group of Anthos Ready Storage vendors expand, because who have we not seen in that list? IBM?
Yep.
Who else have we not seen?
Hitachi.
Hitachi? Yep. Two of the other traditional storage vendors in the data center.
And a lot of the smaller players, the Cumulos, people like that. You have object storage vendors as well.
Yes, anybody who's not necessarily providing block devices through CSI directly into it.
Yeah.
And as you say, quite a lot of the storage vendor software-based storage vendors, which you'd think if you were, air quotes, modernizing your environment, you'd be more interested in looking at. So it's definitely an interesting group. And you know, getting back to what we said already, it does make me wonder if this is focused on more picking out partners who could help them get access to customers rather than necessarily providing wider support for the requirements that people might have.
Yeah, I think it's very much it's Google trying to gain more footholds.
Mm.
And I think all the cloud vendors are trying to do that. How do we get these footholds into the enterprise? Google's approach is to partner with people. Amazon's approach is to say, actually, we're the biggest and the best. Come and talk to us. Microsoft's approach is, we're Microsoft. We know how to run Microsoft's workloads better than anybody. And Oracle's, I'm not sure what Oracle's approach is, apart from saying that we're Oracle and we've got the best database in the world and we don't care what anybody else says.
Isn't Oracle's approach to say, well, you owe us loads of money on other licenses.
Yeah.
So we'll just give you free cloud licenses and call it quits. Yeah. I think that's their approach.
Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you think we've missed?
I'm sure there's loads we've missed, and I'm sure there's loads of people going to be listening to this saying we completely missed the point, and it would be quite good to get some of them on. Anyone from any one of these vendors or anybody from Google Cloud who wants to come and talk to us about what they're doing or what the thinking is behind Anthos Ready Storage, which is a bit worrying, actually, because they only need to add an E in there, and they've got a very unfortunate acronym.
Yes, let's hope they don't come out with Anthos Ready Storage
Enterprise.
Extended. Enterprise, yeah. otherwise we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay, on that note, Martin, I think we'll call it a day. That was a great conversation. Look forward to catching up with you soon.
And you, Chris.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.